Rolling Stone.
Wanna see our pictures on the cover.
Stone.
Wanna buy 5 copies for our mother.
Yeah.
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, continuing to read from a special collector's edition of Rolling Stone, Bob Dylan, The Complete Album Guide. In our last session, we'd gotten to about 1980, and some of the albums during this phase of Bob Dylan's career are very obscure, and the reviews by Rolling Stone are quite brief. So I'm going to omit a few of them, and we'll come back to them if we have time during this reading session. The next review is of the Infidels album, this by Corey Grohe. His religious phase behind him, Dylan got down to making impassioned rock and roll again, and this album was released in October of 1983. That religious period was all part of my experience, Dylan said in 1983. It had to happen. When I get involved in something, I get totally involved. I don't just play around on the fringes. Dylan returned to secular rock and roll with Infidels, his most focused album since Blood on the Tracks. The reboot began sometime in 1982, when he took a rare break from performing after spending nearly 2 years straight on the road. During his time off, Dylan asked several artists, including Frank Zappa, David Bowie, and Elvis Costello, all of whom he felt had a better handle on modern technology, to produce his next record. He ultimately reached out to Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits, who'd played on Slow Train Coming. You have to learn to adapt to the way different people work, Knopfler said in 1984. It was strange at times with Bob. Each song has its own secret that's different from another song, and each has its own life. Knopfler led a Dream Team backing band, powerhouse reggae rhythm section Sly Dunbar and Robbie Shakespeare, former Rolling Stones guitarist Mick Taylor. We formed an instant friendship, Taylor recalled, and Knopfler's Dire Straits bandmate Alan Clark on keys. Together, the group recorded crisp versions of 16 Dylan originals and 14 covers. Only 8 of those songs would end up on the album. The sessions began on April 11, 1983, with a run-through of Blind Willie McTell, a profound tune about being aware of one's own mortality. Dylan attempted it 21 times that day alone, but it never made the album. In 2006, he said he left it off the record because, quote, it was never developed fully, unquote. It would be a highlight of the bootleg series volumes 1 through 3. Over the course of about a month, the group went over each song meticulously, playing the eventual outtake, Foot of Pride, a whopping 44 times. The only single-take recording to appear on the album was the incendiary shot at hypermasculine aggression, Licensed to Kill. Despite Dylan's perfectionism, Dunbar recalls Dylan as being cool and easygoing at the sessions. He just came with his harmonicas on his neck and his guitar, the drummer says of his first impression of Dylan. He played a couple of songs, and we just fell in love with the groove and played over and over. He would change the key to see which one sounds better, and we'd keep on playing and playing, and then it's recorded. Next song was the same thing. Infidels ended up being Dylan's most political album since the 60s. On Union Sundown, he updated the tradition of pro-labor anthems with a rant against outsourcing. Neighborhood Bully was Dylan's read on the situation in the Middle East. Joker Man was a shot at shallow politicians. The oddest moment was Licensed to Kill, where Dylan condemned space travel, singing, "Man has invented his doom. First step was touching the moon." "I just write 'em as they come, you know," he said in 1984. Of course, Dylan was cagey when addressing what many fans saw as an artistic rejuvenation. "They're not about anything different than what I've written about, but they're probably put together in a way that other ones aren't put together," Dylan said. "So it might seem like something new. I don't think I've found any new chords or new progressions or any new words that haven't been said before. I think they're pretty much all the same old thing, just kinda reworked. The next album review is of Empire Burlesque, this by Andy Green. Dylan got together with a hip-hop pioneer for a glossy 80s misfire. Arthur Baker was a 29-year-old New York-based music producer, best known for his work on Afrika Bambaataa's groundbreaking hip-hop single, Planet Rock, and a radio-friendly dance remix of Bruce Springsteen's Dancing in the Dark, when Columbia Records asked him to take over the new Dylan album. "I was fucking blown away," Baker says. "I was a huge fan in high school and just in awe of the guy." Baker originally dreamed of crafting a classic old-school Dylan album, but the label had a very different idea. "They wanted him to sound modern, and basically my job was to give him more production," says Baker. "What I liked about Dylan was not production, but him and his voice." It turned out that Dylan had been in various studios for the previous few months, hammering his way through a mess of an album with a rotating crew of musicians, including Jim Keltner, Al Kooper, and Tom Petty's Heartbreakers. He had stellar songs like Tight Connections to My Heart, Has Anybody Seen My Love, and Seeing the Real You at Last, but they all needed serious work. "I was trying to go for bells and whistles and the Phil Spector thing," says Baker. "It was the peak of the 1980s where everything was synthesizers and big drum sounds." Dylan grew weary of the laborious process. "He had no patience when we were mixing," says Baker. He went, "We mixed Blonde on Blonde in 2 days, the whole album." "I explained to him that was a four-track album and we were using 48 tracks. He finally went out to see the movie Mask and came back just blown away. He said, 'I didn't know they were making movies like that anymore.' He was just so impressed with Cher. Another time we were mixing and I heard something really weird, so I turned down the sound, and Bob was playing a guitar in the corner, singing Like a Virgin. He said, 'Can we make a record like Prince or Madonna?' He was totally pulling my leg." The album was practically in the can when Baker told Dylan it should end with an acoustic song. "I didn't have anything," Dylan wrote in Chronicles. He returned to his hotel and wrote Dark Eyes about a woman he'd seen in the lobby. "She looked like she was beaten up and was afraid she'd get beaten up again," he explained. Dylan promoted Empire Burlesque with a video for Tight Connection to My Heart, in which he even danced a little, but the glossy album was doomed to fail. "I cringe at some of the shit I did on that record," Baker says. "It could have been better." Now we're on to Oh Mercy, released in September of 1989. This review is by David Brown. How U2's producer helped Dylan sound modern yet timeless once again. On an afternoon in early 1989, a group of musicians gathered at a house tucked away on a quiet street in New Orleans. Inside, amplifiers were set up in closets and a studio had been built in the kitchen. When you looked at the house from the outside, you would never dream a whole studio was set up in there, recalls percussionist Cyril Neville of the Neville Brothers. At least one of the musicians, local guitarist Mason Ruffner, had no idea who he'd be recording with. When Dylan emerged in a sweatshirt with the hood pulled over his head, Ruffner's response was, "Oh shit, I don't think I'm worthy of this." After his run of disastrous 80s albums, Dylan wasn't so confident himself. "It was either come up with a bunch of songs that were original and pay attention to them, or get some other real good songwriters to write me some songs," he said. Dylan had been working on a batch of new material, some just lyrics, some with the barest of melodies, and one night he showed the lyrics to Bono, who in turn suggested Dylan work with David Lanois, the Canadian producer who'd worked on U2's The Unforgettable Fire and The Joshua Tree. "I was looking to make a masterpiece for Bob Dylan," says Lanois, "and I wanted him to be the center of the picture. I didn't care about the framing." Dylan liked the setup Lenoy had arranged at the house in New Orleans, complete with alligator heads and odd stuffed animals strewn about. As Dylan recalled, "You didn't have to walk through secretaries, pinball machines, and managers and hangers-on in the lobby, and parking lots and elevators and Arctic temperatures." Yet despite the idyllic setting, the album that would become Oh Mercy got off to a less than promising start. One day, Dylan left at the end of a session with what he thought was a solid take of Political World, a chugging rocker. But when he returned the next day, he was shocked to hear Lenoy's atmospheric mix. A frustrated Lenoy smashed his dobro on the floor, sending one of the studio assistants fleeing from the room in tears. "I thought, this is only the first song," Dylan later wrote. "It should be easier than this." Dylan would take repeated stabs at the tunes, each one with a different tempo and feel. Meanwhile, Lenoy felt Dylan was falling into old, lazy habits. "Maybe he was feeling a little pressure," Ruffner says. "He disagreed just to disagree sometimes with Daniel." But the songs began to take shape, the sulking ballad most of the time, the anguished ballad, "What Good Am I?" and the stately "Ring Them Bells." "I didn't want to have a lot of clanging around on this record," said Lenoy, who recorded Dylan playing over a Roland SOS drum machine, the same one Marvin Gaye used on Sexual Healing, and then brought in the Neville Brothers' Willie Green for overdubs. "I wanted to concentrate on the lyrics and the sound of the voice." Oh Mercy felt modern yet timeless, accessible yet imbued with ambiguity. Dylan, never known for loving his studio records, would call it haunting, not stumbling or halting. To thank Lenoy, Dylan drew a sketch of the producer and gave it to him as a gift, returning later in the rain, because he had forgotten to sign it. "If someone has been great," says Lenoy, "they can be great all over again." We're skipping forward to September of 1997, when Dylan released Time Out of Mind. This review by Joe Levy. Addressing the dread realities of life, Dylan made his best album since Blood on the Tracks. In 1996, Dylan met Daniel Lenoy in a hotel room in New York. He wanted Lenoy to listen to some lyrics that he'd put together and tell him if there was enough there for his first collection of original songs in more than half a decade. Dylan and Lenoy had not much kept in touch since the contentious New Orleans sessions for Oh Mercy in 1989. That contention, and the results it produced, may have been part of what Dylan was looking for. The two were about to make an album that, Dylan would later tell Rolling Stone, quote, "was getting me back in and fighting my way out of a corner," unquote. And he picked a sparring partner who'd helped him do it once before. What Lenoy heard that day were songs that focused on what Dylan called the dread realities of life. "They had a lot in them," Lenoy says today. "They had regret and hope, beauty and optimism, a lot of life experience. They were so complex." There weren't yet any melodies. Bob said, "Well, this could go any way we want," says Lenoy. But if the music wasn't set, the intention was. Dylan asked Lenoy to listen to old rock and roll and blues records, Little Willie John, Arthur Alexander, Little Walter, Charlie Patton. "Great early American recording prior to experimentation," Lenoy says. "It had the simplicity, presence, and power, a sense of music unfolding in real time and space that Dylan was out to capture. I wanted something that goes through the technology and comes out the other end before the technology knows what it's doing," he'd tell New York Times writer John Perels. "Many of my records are more or less blueprints for the songs. This time, I didn't want blueprints. I wanted the real thing." But getting the sound of that real thing wouldn't be easy. Work on Time Out of Mind would begin with demos in September 1996 and not finish until March 1997. The sessions would involve more than a dozen musicians playing live while Dylan sang over the music. arguments would be had, guitars would be smashed, and in the end, 3 Grammys would be won, with the album and the renewed vigor of the concerts that followed it, marking a turning point for an artist who many saw as no longer capable of work this commanding. Looking for the spark of the old records Dylan had recommended, Lanois began by working with producer Tony Mangurian in Mangurian's small New York studio. The two played percussion over Patton's Delta Blues, then stripped the original recordings out and looped 8-bar sections into 15 or so grooves to help set the mood and direction of what was to come. These loops may have been a response to Beck's mix of the blues with hip-hop's aesthetic. Dylan was very interested in Beck, Lanois' engineer Mark Howard told Uncut magazine. The original idea was, we do all this collaging and cut and paste. That idea was explored during demo sessions at Lanois' studio in Oxnard, California, called the Teatro, and built in a former theater. Dylan's Point Doom house in Malibu was about 45 minutes south, and throughout September and October, he'd drive up whenever he wanted to work out the songs. Dylan came and went, sometimes working with his road band, sometimes with Lanois, Howard and Mangurian, playing over the loops Lanois had made in New York. Eventually, demos were cut for 6 of the 11 songs that would appear on Time Out of Mind, as well as others. I wanted to make the record at the Teatro because the place had the very best vibe, Lanois says. The eeriness of the empty theater added to the timeless feel he was after. But before the sessions began in January, Dylan threw Lanois one of the change-ups he was famous for. In a phone call Lanois has described as crushing, Dylan explained he didn't want to record so close to home. He wanted to put together a band and go to Miami. Bob wasn't really interested in experimentation. He just wanted a rawness to come from a band, Lanois says. They convened at Criteria Studios, now the Hit Factory, in North Miami. If Lanois couldn't be at the Teatro, he could bring some of it with him. He had Howard drive a truck loaded with equipment to Florida. Dylan had called in musicians from his road band, bassist Tony Garnier, drummer David Kemper, and pedal steel guitarist Bucky Baxter, and other trusted players, like organist Augie Myers and Jim Dixon, the Memphis producer and pianist who'd played on the Rolling Stones' Wild Horses, among others. We spent 30 days in the studio, says Myers today. We'd start around 1 in the afternoon and sometimes go to 11. We'd work on a song for half an hour or 15 minutes, and we'd cut it. But the sessions proceeded with stops and starts. Lanois would direct some of the stuff, but Bob would come in and say, I hear it more this way, says Myers. Sometimes Bob would put down his guitar and just walk out. Half hour later, somebody would say, Bob's outside riding his bike. He'd have to be by himself to figure out what he really wanted, and he did it that way. Tensions boiled over as they worked on Cold Iron's Bound, which began, according to Kemper, when Dylan found the drummer in the studio playing around with a Cuban-influenced disco beat. Dylan sat down next to him, writing lyrics on a yellow legal pad. When the rest of the band got there, they cut the song in 2 takes. Lanois was not pleased. The world doesn't want another 2-note melody from Bob, he told Kemper and Garnier. It was one of his guitar-breaking incidents, Kemper said. Mississippi went no better. The song was pretty much laid out intact melodically, lyrically, and structurally. But Lanois didn't see it, Dylan told Rolling Stone in 2001. After he'd recut Mississippi for Love and Theft. Lanois wanted a more polyrhythmic arrangement. They adjourned to the parking lot to hash it out, a habit during the sessions. Dylan felt the song had more to do with the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights than some steamy cauldron of drum theory. Lanois can get passionate about what he feels to be true, Dylan said. He's not above smashing guitars. I never cared about that unless it was one of mine. If it takes a fight, you gotta fight, Lanois said. I'm not there to be a nice guy and make it go nice and smooth. I don't do medium records. It's not a masterpiece. It's going to be a fight. If it's not a fucking masterpiece, get the fuck out of my face. Lanoy says he sent Kemper home, and two drummers were brought in to replace him, Jim Keltner and Brian Blade. The sessions swelled. Bob had, for want of a better word, an orchestral concept, this thing of too many instruments in the room, the late Dickinson told Uncut. Dylan was standing, singing 4 feet from the microphone, with no earphones on. He was listening to the sound in the room, which is the sound that did not go on the record. I truly never saw anything like it. He was in unspoken control of 23 people. Dylan sometimes froze Lanoy out, refusing to talk directly with him, and dealing with Howard instead. Dickinson, who characterized the sessions as an hour of chaos, leading to 5 or 8 minutes of absolute clarity, believed Dylan used Lanoy to know what it was he wanted and what he didn't want. But in both the sessions and the mixing afterward, Lanoy certainly set the sound of time out of mind. He would urge the musicians to avoid playing too much and playing automatic riffs, he says. He asked them to think of themselves as leaves on a tree that Dylan was passing by. You are not the center of the attraction here. Play harmonic support and no licks, no funny stuff. The tension of Miami dissipated when Lanoy and Howard returned to the Teatro. Dylan was deeply engaged in post-production, overdubbing not just new guitar parts and solos, but new lyrics and chords as well. He was really curious about getting everything right, says Lanoy. And Dylan was also far more convivial than in Miami, spending hours in the Teatro telling stories and asking Lanoy to snap a picture of him there, which became the album cover. In May 1997, 4 months before the album was released, Dylan was struck with histoplasmosis, a fungal infection that caused swelling around his heart and left him in immense pain. I thought I'd be seeing Elvis soon, he said after he'd recovered that June. The health scare colored reception of Time Out of Mind, with many seeing songs about lovesickness as meditations on mortality. People say Time Out of Mind is sort of dark and foreboding because we locked into that one dimension in the sound, Dylan told Rolling Stone. People say the record deals with mortality, my mortality for some reason. Well, it doesn't deal with my mortality. It maybe just deals with mortality in general. It's one thing that we all have in common, isn't it? Next up is the September 2001 release, Love and Theft. This review is by David Brown. Dylan plundered the entire history of American music and turned in a stone-cold classic. At the dawn of the 21st century, Dylan seemed to be on a creative roll. His last LP, 1997's Time Out of Mind, had recently taken home a Grammy for Album of the Year, and in 2000 he won the Best Original Song Oscar for Things Have Changed from the movie Wonder Boys. Another artist might have been content with all that, especially an artist about to turn 60. But the greatest late-career reemergence in rock history was just getting started. When work began on Love and Theft in May 2001, guitarist Larry Campbell was among the first to sense the album would be something special. Right after they'd recorded Things Have Changed, Dylan played Campbell chord changes for one of his new songs, Po' Boy. They were relatively sophisticated changes for a Bob Dylan song, Campbell recalls. That was the first inkling of what the material might be like, taking elements from the jazz era and adding a folk sensibility to it. Sure enough, Dylan would be looking to a specific pre-rock past for inspiration. All my songs, the styles I work in, were all developed before I was born, he said at the time. When I came into the world, that spirit of things was still very strong. Billie Holiday was still alive, Duke Ellington. All those old blues singers were still alive, and that was the music that was dear to me. I was never really interested in pop music. True to his word, Dylan would deliver an album steeped in Chicago blues, Tin Pan Alley crooning, jump blues, and Western swing. Supporting Dylan on that journey was his then-current band, one of the sharpest ensembles ever to back him up. Guitarist Charlie Sexton, guitarist, fiddler, banjo player Campbell, bassist Tony Garnier, and drummer David Kemper. When the sessions finally began at Clinton Recording in Midtown Manhattan, Dylan would arrive each day around 3 p.m. in swanky duds, white Western shirt, peg pants, pull out his guitar and get to work. In typical Dylan code of silence, the sessions were booked under the name of his manager, and studio employees were told not to tell anyone they were making a record with Dylan until it was finished. The Love and Theft sessions were some of the most productive and least predictable of Dylan's career. Studio employees were told Dylan wanted to sing while sitting in a corner of the room, his back to the band, a scenario probably inspired by the cover of Robert Johnson's King of the Delta Blues Singers, Volume 2. No sooner had the band begun playing one of its first songs when Dylan stood up, walked over to a nearby piano, and stayed there for the rest of the day. It was, "Okay, we're doing this now," recalls Campbell. He was kind of like a dog that has to circle the bed a few times before he can relax. On any given day, Dylan might have played the band members a vintage recording by Holiday or Jimmy Rushing. He'd have them learn that song and then ask them to adapt that feel and arrangement to his own tune. But after listening back to a take, Dylan would just as often ask the musicians to change their instruments and adapt different keys or tempos for that song. What surprised me was how quickly he would abandon an arrangement when he was working, engineer Chris Shaw says. He'd say, "What's the tempo? Let's do it in F and drop the tempo down, and do it like a Western swing tune, and I want the drummer to play brushes, not drums." And suddenly the song was completely different. Nothing was set in stone until he found that key, tempo, and style that fit the vocal and that lyric. Dylan knew how to push his band's collective buttons. If the band wasn't grasping what he wanted, Shaw says, he was frustrated and would kick them in the ass by listening to the last take and saying, "I guess I don't have the manpower to make this song work. I'll just go out there myself with my guitar." The band would say, "No, no," and get their shit together. As Campbell admits, "When we went on to the next tune, I guess that's when you knew we'd got it in one form or another. In need of a different mood to follow the hard-churning boogie of Tweedledee and Tweedledum, Dylan, at the suggestion of his manager, recut Mississippi, a song he'd recorded and dropped from Time Out of Mind, and later offered to Sheryl Crow. Since they'd never recorded a full LP with Dylan before, the band also learned to keep out of his musical way. The guitarists would receive stink-eye looks from him if they played too many fancy licks while he was singing, and not to worry about mistakes. If you get a microscope and plow through some of these tracks, you're going to hear some odd chord choices in place, an errant note here or there, Campbell says. But Bob would feel like something was right when it felt right. I had a few things I really wanted to redo, and he said, "No, man, it's fine. That's the way it's supposed to be." After the sometimes contentious Time Out of Mind sessions with producer David Lanois, Dylan had decided to produce Love and Theft himself under the pseudonym Jack Frost. "We didn't know who Jack Frost was until we saw it on the album," says Augie Myers, the Roots music organist and former Sir Douglas Quintet member who'd been called upon to play on the LP, as he had on Time Out of Mind. Taking control seemed to suit Dylan, even as he was prepping to follow up a landmark like Time Out of Mind. "Bob was a little more relaxed when we did Love and Theft," Myers says. You could see it in his body language. When an executive from Columbia stopped by to hear some tracks, Dylan kept alluding to an acoustic version of Cry a While that didn't exist, just to yank the executive's chain. Seeing a new issue of Rolling Stone in the studio featuring Destiny's Child on the cover, with the cover line, "Booty Camp," Dylan was inspired to slip the phrase, "booty call," into Cry a While. Dylan told Shaw he wanted to release a live album, but with all the dates and cities listed incorrectly to mess with the heads of Dylanologists. When it was wrapped up, the album, its title inspired by historian Eric Lott's 1993 study, Love and Theft, Blackface Minstrelry and the American Working Class, could be as somber and austere as Time Out of Mind, with Dylan's increasingly gnarled voice now the equivalent of a weathered oak tree. Basically, the songs deal with what many of my songs deal with, which is business, politics, and war, and maybe love interest on the side, Dylan said at the time. The whole album deals with power. If life teaches us anything, it's that there's nothing that men and women won't do to get power. The album deals with power, wealth, knowledge, and salvation, the way I look at it. One especially potent standout, High Water for Charlie Patton, was apocalyptic country blues named after the Johnson-era Delta blues man. I listen to High Water now, and it's sort of like the Bible, says Crow. You read verses in the Bible, and you can't believe how much they're saying or what's happening now. In High Water, there's one line in particular. "Don't reach out for me," she said. "Can't you see I'm drowning too?" That's not only what's happening in the political realm, but what's happening environmentally. There's high water everywhere. The album could also be playful and whimsical. The Bing Crosby-esque Moonlight and the jump blues of Summer Days and the crooning in Bye Bye, its arrangement inspired by Holiday's languid 1938 song, Having Myself a Time, were the sound of a man at ease with himself in the past. He's able to turn a melody and create a twist, and then he delivers it like a crooner, says Crow. I love that. Yet Love and Theft was no mere Americana trip any more than The Times They Are a-Changin' was merely a protest album. The pre-rock genres he drew upon never sounded so vibrant and plugged in. Dylan was respectful of American roots music, but not reverent toward it, a crucial distinction. And perhaps reflecting his own renaissance and his recovery from a heart issue a few years earlier, Dylan rarely sounded so wily and alive. Love and Theft took on chilling additional resonance when its official release date, September 11th, coincided with the terror attacks in New York and Washington, D.C. On message boards, Dylanologists tried to read their own meanings into the lyrics, like interpreting Tweedledee and Tweedledum as a premonition about the Twin Towers. There were conspiracy people trying to prove Bob was prescient about the 9/11 events, how he had seen this coming and written it into the songs, says Campbell. Paul is dead kind of stuff. But I also think many people found a new Bob Dylan record as sort of refuge from the insanity of that whole event. Dylan, who saw the album as the first part of a trilogy that would go on to include Modern Times and Together Through Life, would continue to frolic in a deep reservoir of American music. Hopefully, it would also speak across the ages, he said of Love and Theft. That's what I was trying to make happen, because just to make another record at this point in my career, I don't feel like what I do qualifies to be called a career. It's more of a calling. August 2006 saw the release of Modern Times. This review is by Will Hermes. A roots odyssey that explores tradition without pining for the past. The second album in Dylan's 21st century trilogy of deep roots recordings was finished in the wake of Chronicles, his 2004 biography, and Martin Scorsese's epic documentary, No Direction Home. Yet, like the singer told a journalist while promoting the LP, there's no nostalgia on this record. Pining for the past doesn't interest me. Still, the new set looked to Dylan's early 20th century American musical heroes, sometimes as on Love and Theft, quite literally, for inspiration. And like that second installment, Dylan again decided to direct the recording himself. I didn't feel like I wanted to be overproduced anymore, he said. I felt I've always produced my own records anyway, except I just had someone there in the way. Once again, he convened his road band for the recording, which now featured Austin blues guitarist master Denny Freeman, who recalls playing most of the leads on Dylan's own Gibson 175 hollow body. Dylan felt at the time it was, man for man, the best band I've ever had. When you play with guys 100 times a year, you know what you can and you can't do, what they're good at, whether you want them there, he told author Jonathan Lethem in Rolling Stone. It takes a long time to find a band of individual players. On this record, I didn't have anybody to teach. I got guys now in my band, they can whip up anything. They surprise even me. The band gathered each day at Clinton Studios in New York, usually arraying themselves in a circle, with Dylan directing from behind a keyboard, and worked up the songs, ultimately recording them live, according to Freeman. Yet Modern Times proved to be one of Dylan's most difficult records to complete, where he and the band blasted out 12 songs in 12 days for Love and Theft. This one took close to a month of hard labor. One might have guessed at the effort from his interviews. "I don't like to make records," Dylan said upon its release. "I do it reluctantly." Freeman confirms the sessions were a challenge. "The arrangements are clean, logical, efficient, melodic, and the songs have a certain simplicity, in the good sense of simplicity," the guitarist says. "So it sounds like it must have been a pretty easy project, but that ain't the way I remember it. It was not easy. We worked on these songs a lot, and I remember thinking it was very difficult to get to a place where Bob was happy. So some of the songs took a long time." According to Dylan, Nettie Moore was the song that troubled me the most because I wasn't sure I was getting it right. But it may be the album's emotional high point. Jumping off from a parlor ballad dating back to at least the mid-19th century, The Little White Cottage, or Gentle Nettie Moore, boasts lyrics that nod to a number of early American songs, including Robert Johnson's "Hellhound on My Trail," describing a heartbreak so intense the singer sees a world gone black before my eyes. Dylan delivers portions of the song in something near a sob. In the end, he knew he nailed it. "Finally, I could see what the song is about. This is coherent, not just a bunch of random verses," he said. "We all heard people knock his singing, and it's a different kind of singing than Tony Bennett," says Freeman of the performance. "But golly, he's not kidding around. I don't know if you can get a singer with more conviction. When he sings it, he means it." The lilting ballad "Working Man's Blues No. 2 is another object lesson in this, an explicit nod to Merle Haggard's 1969 hit, "Working Man Blues," even copying the bulk of its titular reprise, "A Little Bit of Those Working Man Blues." This is Dylan fleshing out a character from 100 years ago, or yesterday, over a stately march as lyrical as any he'd ever written. This is the voice of a man beyond politics, who might vote Republican, but can pronounce proletariat as well as Woody Guthrie. "I can't really say that Bob has not worked in a field all day behind some plow with an ox in front of him, you know, with his hands bleeding from blisters and stuff," Freeman says. "When he sings about things like that in his songs, you think he has." Blues, in fact, define the record in various forms. "Thunder on the Mountain" is an upbeat roadhouse shuffle with Chuck Berry inflected riffs and punchlines to burn, whether Dylan's rhyming "sons of bitches" with "orphanages" or testifying to an obsession with singer Alicia Keys. "I remember seeing her on the Grammys," Dylan said. "I think I was on the show with her. I didn't meet her or anything, but I said to myself, there's nothing about that girl I don't like." The figure of Muddy Waters also looms large. Dylan reinterprets "Rollin' and Tumblin'," one of the oldest American blues standards, one that Waters cut a definitive version of. And he channels the Chicago legend's "Trouble No More" on the boisterous "Someday Baby," a slow, stately, shimmering outtake version of the song. See Telltale Signs, the Bootleg Series Volume 8, demonstrates how much Dylan's approaches would vary. That was when he was getting frustrated with the more upbeat version not coming together, said session engineer Chris Shaw. After dinner, he walked back into the room and George Riccelli, his drummer, was tapping out that groove. Bob sat down at the piano, and all of a sudden they came out with that version. We raced to record it. It was only done in one or two takes. He likes to try out a lot of different ideas, radically different ideas, on the same song, recalls Freeman. He likes to try coming at it from a bunch of different ways. A lot of times, he would make a left turn, and the original idea would end up being unrecognizable from where we began. Whatever the efforts behind the scene, the result was a set that feels effortless and timeless. It's a credit to him, Freeman says. He was the editor of everything. I'm really proud that I got to be part of a very beautiful piece of work. We're getting to the end of the Dylan collection. The next few reviews are fairly brief, but interesting nonetheless. In the April 2009 release, Together Through Life, Dylan ended his Roots trilogy with old friends and a new instrument. The last panel in Dylan's 21st Century American Roots triptych is pretty much a straight-up blues record, observes Los Lobos David Hidalgo, who played on the album. Dylan wanted to do blues, but less straight-up. The resulting work is one of Dylan's most interesting stylistic melting pots. Together Through Life grew out of a soundtrack commission. The French director Olivier Dayen approached me about composing some songs for a film he was writing and directing, Dylan said. We started off with Life is Hard, and then the record sort of took its own direction. The movie, My Own Love Song, a drama about a wheelchair-bound singer, starring Renee Zellweger and Forrest Whitaker, never saw a wide release. The album's sound was largely defined by accordion, a nod to both Hidalgo's Chicano roots and, surely not by accident, Dayen's Gallic heritage. I wished I had used the accordion more on some of my past records, Dylan said. It's a perfect instrument in a lot of ways. It's orchestrative and percussive at the same time. Actually, accordion players were the first musicians that I had seen a lot of growing up. Dylan showed a collaborative spirit in other ways. Most of the songs are co-written with Grateful Dead lyricist Robert Hunter. We're from the same old school, so it makes its own kind of sense, Dylan said. He may have exhumed some lyrics from a writing session with Hunter back in the summer of 1995, following Jerry Garcia's wake. In the studio, Heartbreakers guitarist Mike Campbell was also on hand. He always plays exactly what is needed, says Hidalgo. Some were disappointed that Campbell didn't stretch out more, but Dylan defended his arrangements. Nobody buys my albums to hear solos. The next album was rather unusual for Dylan. Released in October of 2009, Christmas in the Heart is filled with Yuletide favorites delivered with humor and holiday cheer. Dylan was raised Jewish, but he'd always loved Christmas music. While reporting a Rolling Stone feature in 1986, Michael Gilmore saw Dylan lead an impressive a cappella choral arrangement of White Christmas during the Knocked Out Loaded sessions, and Dylan cut unreleased versions of Hark the Herald Angels Sing and Silent Night for Infidels. Still, his 2009 collection of Christmas songs, a fundraising LP for charities fighting hunger and homelessness, was one of his most unexpected decisions ever, even for his sidemen. I didn't know it was going to be a Christmas record, recalls multi-instrumentalist David Hidalgo. I showed up to the recording session thinking, okay, it might be something similar to the last one. I think the first song we did was Silver Bells, and I was like, wait a minute. It struck some as a joke, and to be sure, there's some humor involved. But it's more joyous than perverse. Winter Wonderland is Gene Autry-style countrypolitan schmaltz. It Must Be Santa is arranged as a sort of Yiddish polka. I first heard that song years ago on one of those Sing Along with Mitch records, Dylan recalled. The sessions certainly sound like they were fun, and they gathered together a venerable group of musicians. That album was really cool because I got to sit next to Phil Upchurch, the guitarist who played with the Staple Singers, Hidalgo Notes. That was a real honor. Ultimately, this was a project just as serious about American tradition as Dylan's 2000s trilogy of Roots records, and it anticipated his 2015 standard set, Shadows in the Night. "These songs are part of my life, just like folk songs," he said. "You have to play them straight." In September of 2012, Dylan released Tempest. At 71, Dylan made what might be the darkest album of his career. Dylan began working out material for Tempest during sound checks in 2011, but he couldn't decide if he wanted to make an album of religious songs or a secular record. "The religious songs maybe I felt were too similar to each other to release as an album," he told Rolling Stone's Michael Gilmore. "Someplace along the line, I had to go with one or the other, and Tempest is what I went with. I'm still not sure it was the right decision." It ended up being perhaps the darkest record Dylan has ever made. Tempest begins with the rollicking Duquesne Whistle, a likely outtake from Together Through Life, but the tone soon blackens with murderous songs like Pay in Blood, Soon After Midnight, and Tin Angel. "There's plenty of death songs," Dylan told Gilmore. "You may well know in folk music, every other song deals with death. Everybody sings them. Death is a part of life." Recording started in early 2012 at Jackson Browne's Groove Masters in Santa Monica with Dylan's longtime touring band, David Hidalgo, who contributed accordion, violin, and guitar, was the only outside player invited to join. "My job is to add some color to what was already there," he says. "The band has played with him for so long, it just all falls together." The album ends with Roll On John, a 7.5-minute tribute to John Lennon. "I wasn't even sure that song fit on this record," Dylan said. "I just took a chance and stuck it on there." Then there's the title track, a 14-minute, 45-verse song about the sinking of the Titanic, though the lyric, "Leo took his sketchbook," drags the narrative closer to James Cameron's movie than to actual history. "People are going to say, well, it's not very truthful," said Dylan. "But a songwriter doesn't care about what's truthful. What he cares about is what should have happened, what could have happened. That's its own kind of truth." The next release by Dylan in February of 2015 was Shadows in the Night, a Sinatra-influenced set of standards from the American Songbook. The notion of doing a full set of American Songbook standards in the vein of Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett was something Dylan had been considering for decades. "Ever since I heard Willie Nelson's Stardust record in the late 70s, I thought I could do that too," he said. But his label chief was unenthusiastic, and the idea was nixed. In retrospect, Columbia Records president Walter Yetnikoff was probably right, Dylan conceded. "It was most likely too soon for me to make a record of standards." As Dylan entered his mid-70s, the time was finally right. He decided to record in Los Angeles at Capitol's Studio B, a room Sinatra often recorded in, acting as producer with help from engineer Al Schmidt, a Sinatra recording vet. "We did 2 3-hour sessions every day for 3 weeks, 5 days a week," Schmidt recalled. "At the start of each session, we'd all be there in the live room to listen to the old Frank Sinatra recording of the song we were going to record, not to approach it in the same way, but to get an idea of the interpretation. Traditional settings were largely off the table. A producer would have come in and said, let's put strings here and a horn section there, but I wasn't going to do that," Dylan told an interviewer for AARP, the magazine. Instead, alongside longtime touring bandmates, Dylan enlisted a number of brass players to create a low-key and unusual mix underneath some of the most beautiful singing he'd ever done. "Comparing me with Frank Sinatra? You must be joking," he said. "To be mentioned in the same breath as him must be some sort of high compliment. As far as touching him goes, nobody touches him. Fallen Angels, released in May of 2016, was Dylan's second LP of standards, and it was as intimate as its predecessor. In May 2016, Dylan released a second collection of songs recorded during the 3 weeks of sessions that produced Shadows in the Night, once again primarily devoted to music associated with Frank Sinatra. The album was cut live, with engineer Al Schmidt essentially mixing it as it unfolded, one thing Sinatra and Dylan had in common, besides blue eyes, was a fondness for working quickly. There was no editing, no fixing, no tuning, Schmidt said. Everything was just the way it was. I don't see myself as covering these songs in any way, Dylan said of his ongoing Great American Songbook project. They've been covered enough, buried, as a matter of fact. What me and my band are basically doing is uncovering them, lifting them out of the grave and bringing them into the light of day. Dylan reshaped the songs, some of them among Sinatra's best-known material, like Young at Heart and That Old Black Magic, with string band renditions full of space for Tony Garnier's upright bass and Donnie Herron's pedal steel. The transformation recalled Elvis Presley's Sun Sessions reworking of the Rodgers and Hart ballad Blue Moon as a ghostly mountain call. The studio was given what Schmidt called a living room atmosphere. Bob did not want to see a lot of microphones around, he said, so I had to use as few as possible and to try and disguise the ones that were there as much as I could. We knew these songs pretty well, Dylan wrote. It was all done live, maybe one or two takes, no overdubbing, no vocal boots, no headphones. Before each take, Dylan and his band would listen to the Sinatra rendition of the tune they were about to tackle, not to set a course, but to put wind in their sails. When I recorded these songs, I had to make believe that I never heard of Sinatra, that he didn't exist, Dylan told Bill Flanagan. He's a guide. He'll point the way and lead you to the entrance, but from there, you're on your own. The final Dylan album included here, released in March of 2017, was Triplicate, a three-disc set that showed how deep his journey of the heart went. These songs are some of the most heartbreaking stuff ever put on record, and I wanted to do them justice, Dylan said of the classic American music he continued to explore on his third set of standards. Now that I've lived them and lived through them, I understand them better. In February 2016, Dylan returned to the Capitol Records Tower in Los Angeles on Vine Street, just north of Hollywood Boulevard. Once again, he took up residence in Studio B, and over 5 weeks, working from 3 in the afternoon until 11 at night, he sat with his five-piece band arranged around him in a semicircle, joined on a few tracks by a three-piece horn section, and cut 20th century standards. The results were released a year later on a three-disc set, 10 songs per disc, presented thematically, reminiscent of Frank Sinatra's 1980 trilogy set, starting with the lighthearted, I guess I'll have to change my plans, and ending with the sweeping existential, Why Was I Born? Dylan called it a journey of the heart, and felt these old tunes expressed deeply personal feelings, just the way other singers and listeners had, for more than a half century, used his own work to do so. It's a human story that builds to a climax, and it's personal from end to end, he told Bill Flanagan in an interview published on Dylan's website. You go from the foolishly absurd to the deadly serious, and you pass through the gaudy and the nasty along the way. The weathered but sweet vocals were, Dylan felt, simply what the songs demanded. You don't want to be spitting the words out in a crude way, he said. That would be unthinkable. The emphasis is different, and there's no reason to force the vernacular. An airline ticket to romantic places is a contrasting type of phraseology than, say, bury my body by the highway side. The intonation is different, more circumspectual, more internal. This concludes our Dylan album review. But if you're interested in more information about Dylan, there have been several documentaries done over the years that are worth paying attention to, and I'll mention them here. The first is No Direction Home. Dylan's life during the early 60s was so epic that only Martin Scorsese could do it justice. The director personally assembled this patchwork of unseen archival video, photos, and interviews into a 4-hour documentary that's riveting from beginning to end. It even has footage of the famous Judas moment from his 1966 concert tour, which no one even knew existed until it appeared here. The second is Don't Look Back. Director D.A. Pennebaker was lucky enough to be a fly on the wall during Dylan's 1965 tour of England, and he came away with a searing image of the artist in transition, saying goodbye to folk music as he takes great delight in belittling reporters and humiliating Donovan. Most intense moment, Dylan plays a vicious It's All Over Now, Baby Blue to a hotel room full of stunned hangers-on. The next is the 30th anniversary concert celebration. In October 1992, Dylan commemorated 3 decades in the game at Madison Square Garden along with Neil Young, Johnny Cash, George Harrison, Tom Petty, Pearl Jam, Eric Clapton, and many more greats. Dylan steals the show in this excellent concert documentary with a jaw-dropping acoustic version of It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding. The next one is The Other Side of the Mirror, Bob Dylan live at the Newport Folk Festival. No moment in Dylan's history has inspired more myth than his electric set at Newport in 1965. Director Murray Lerner captured it on film. He'd also been at Newport the previous 2 years when Dylan played solo acoustic. Only bits of his footage had been seen up until 2007, when he released it all on this amazing collection. And the final is Gotta Serve Somebody, the gospel songs of Bob Dylan. On the 2003 tribute album Gotta Serve Somebody, a stellar group of gospel artists came together to perform songs from Dylan's oft-maligned Christian period. This documentary shows how it all came together. Among many powerful moments is the Chicago Mass Choir's rendition of Pressing On from the 1980 album Saved, which ranks among the best Dylan covers of all time. This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Wanna see our pictures on the cover? Stone.